The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Trouble in paradise as Sean Canny contemplates his future in the Independent Alliance. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil clash over government spending. And after last night's horrific revelations about the abuse of young girls in foster care, are our most vulnerable children being protected? All that and more on tonight's Late Debate, but first the news with Ray Kennedy. Good evening and welcome to the Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan. Joining us in studio this evening we have child law practitioner, Catherine Gent, Fine Gael Senator Michelle Mulhern, Fianna Fáil TD for Roscommon Galway, Eugene Murphy, Paul Murphy, Solidarity TD for Dublin West, Labour Senator Eoin O'Riordan and Mary Regan, Public Affairs Editor with the Sunday Business Post. Now, we really want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, we're going to turn first to last night's RTE Investigates report by Aoife Hegarty. It featured first-hand testimony from two very brave young women who told their harrowing story of years of rape and abuse at the hands of the son of their foster parents. Catherine Gent, you would have to be blown away by the bravery of Rachel and Sarah in that report last night.
I know, I mean, like I said last night, it was a seminal moment, and I really mean that. I think that I would really like to see that played in every social work department, in every educational institution, which is dealing with social workers, in the forum for judges, for lawyers, for anybody who's going to be in this area, whether it be in the criminal realm or in the child protection realm, because it's really vital that we see this is what it is. Because it's a problem for us in court is, I represent children in court through guardians ad litem, and they can't be seen. And when you actually hear firsthand and really witness firsthand both the effect and just listening to it last night, they have really, really to be commended for doing all of us some service. And I think that it will do service for children coming forward into the future. And I'd really like to make sure that that is the case. So I'd like the educational institutions to pick it up. I'd like the judiciary to pick it up. I'd like lawyers to pick it up. All of those people across those different services that will influence, I'd like them all to have it as required viewing.
Yeah, because I think this is one of the issues under the Child Care Act. In the media, we've had this problem. We've covered this story and stories like this over the years, but there are a lot of sanctions around and complications around anybody who has had been the subject of a care order being shown on screen or being able to tell their story themselves. So it is when you actually you can see now the impact. Mm. And the difference it makes when those stories can be told in the first person.
Oh, you can. And I mean, like, I have had that where there are cases I've dealt with where you say, I'd love people to really know and see this, but you can't put someone that you represent in a vulnerable position. And even sometimes people think, I'll be able to deal with this. Like, you know, the kickback, and we're dealing with social media and all of that today. It's correct that children and vulnerable people in those positions are protected in terms of their identity. And it's really important that that would continue. Equally, when people are empowered to do what these girls have done, it has to be recognised and commended again.
I suppose the main thing when people saw that last night, the question that is inescapable is, how did that happen? How, in particular, was the decision made once Rachel made her disclosure, and once that disclosure was deemed to be credible, that a decision was then made to leave those other children in that foster placement?
Well, I think that is the key question. I mean, I cannot, and I have been thinking about it today, I cannot think of any reason as to why that would have been done. And I know the argument, and I've argued it in different circumstances, that moving a child from a foster placement is a very difficult thing to do, because you're talking about a child who's been removed from their own home, be it because of they've been abused, because of neglect or other issues, and they've had disrupted attachments in their early life, they're trying to form relationships, they're trying to generate stability, and moving children is not a good idea. And the general pattern is that once a child moves, once then they start on this cycle of moving, and that's really, really bad for them, because it takes them away from their communities, it takes them away from other people, in this constant cycle of rejection. However, as Nolan Blackwell said this morning, if you're not in a safe place, then you need to be removed from it. And it really is inexplicable as to how that decision was made. I mean, it was a credible finding of rape. And what is extraordinary was, it wasn't even that the children were left in the home and he was asked to leave. He was there with his parents to supervise, you know, which is just practically impossible in any event because there were a number of foster children. There were two foster children left in the home and his parents supposed to be supervising him. So I really await with interest the reason to be given for that. But I think that what I would like this debate, the outcome of it to be, is that we have a better system. I think that we need to be really conscious in this debate as to say, we're going to ask these questions and we're going to test what people are saying, and that clearly needs to be done because we need to see what went wrong. But we also need to see, well, how do we, and I think there's politicians here tonight, take responsibility to say, well, actually, we're going to work to ensure there's a better system. So we're going to go in and we're going to say, clearly there are resource issues, and there are resource issues. And they're not just funding issues, they're also issues of, for example, social workers, and I mentioned last night getting castigated. Like, there are areas in the country where social workers are facing such a difficult time, in particular courts, that they're getting totally overwhelmed. They're not doing their work. And when they're not doing their work, they're coming in and getting cross-examined by people like me saying, you're not doing your work. And they're saying, well, we don't have anybody in the department. Judges are saying to them, well, why are you not doing the work? And there is almost a culture of public bullying. And that is leading people to leave their jobs. Also, the public approbation is causing people to leave their jobs or not come in. And, you know, we have to change from a situation where it is at the moment, if any of us had a relative going to do social work, you would say to them nearly, like, you really, really want to think about this, to saying, yeah, that's a really good profession to go into. And if you go into it, you're going to be supported. You're going to be educated properly in terms of protection as well as welfare. That's another issue which needs to be looked at in terms of certain, you know, third level courses and the concern that there is more of an emphasis at the moment on welfare issues and not protection. And that if you're constantly looking for signs of safety, that you're in danger of missing signs of danger.
Yeah, now, when I was watching this last night, I was thinking, I worked on a Primetime Investigates called In Harm's Way 10 years ago exactly. Next month it will be 10 years ago since we broadcast that. And I think you actually took part in that, Catherine. And what we looked at in that time was the number of children who were deemed to be at high risk of immediate abuse. They're high risk. And they were allocated as priority one in that. And they were not being allocated a social worker because there simply wasn't enough social workers to go around. And we were being told by the social workers who talked to us for that programme that their offices were in chaos, they were in crisis themselves. And they were, you know, this was the outcome, that there was children in care placements and children in the home who were not being allocated social workers. At the time, this was under the HSE, the Child Protection Services. And we put that to the then National Specialist for Children and Family Services, who was Aidan Waterstone at the time. And here's a clip of his response to our findings.
I would absolutely say that all children who are at serious risk of abuse do have services provided to them. That is without question. Our social workers have to balance the risk factors and the protective factors, and they have to make a decision as to what to do. Now, I am confident that in all situations where a child is at serious and immediate risk, a service is provided.
Are you comfortable that a waiting list is out there? This is a waiting list that was updated a couple of months ago, where 70 children were assessed as being at significant risk of coming to immediate harm, and no social worker was allocated.
I wouldn't be confident now in that information as being absolutely accurate, to be honest. They will obviously present the information in as, I suppose, stark a way as they can.
Are you suggesting social workers are crying wolf in this, that the situation is not as serious as they suggest? Because they are quite clear, the documentation we have seen, they have made it quite clear that they believe this is a very serious, very worrying situation.
Yes. There's no question that our social workers will be crying wolf. What they are doing is, through a service planning process, they are identifying needs. The ones with greatest need are the ones with the allocated social workers.
Now, definitely the response there was, you know, much ado about nothing, that there are, you know, if a child is at risk, there will be a social worker allocated. I was so conscious when I was watching that report last night that at that time when that report was being broadcast, there was two children in that foster placement in a very risky situation. That's 10 years ago. At the time, Catherine, the proposals was, we've got to take it away from the HSC, we've got to set up a standalone service. We've done that. We have TUSLA. And you just wonder, like we've just looked at the HICPA reports lately, there are still hundreds of children in foster care placements who do not at this moment have an allocated social worker.
That's absolutely correct. And I hope that the defensive attitude which was shown in that recording is now not the case. And I think that some of the more conciliatory tones offered by the spokespeople for TISLA has to be welcomed over the next number of days. And I hope that's indicative of a much more open way of dealing with things. Because, I mean, TISLA needs to be its own advocate. They need to be saying, you can't expect us to do our job properly unless we have these people, and you have to create the conditions for which we have them. But, I mean, another issue in relation to allocation, I mean, I was in court this morning and there's a team leader having to come to court to give evidence because there is no social worker assigned. So you have this now, you have team leaders who are the allocated social worker, who are supposed to be supervising teams, assisting, you know, younger social workers, making sure that there's administrative and management things to be done. And they're doing jobs that they shouldn't be doing. I said there's social care workers doing the work of social workers because we don't have them. There's student social workers being sent out to deal with people in circumstances where they just shouldn't. They need to learn. They need to be guided. And it's really important to remember that the people who abuse children are often incredibly manipulative and deceptive. And, you know, it came through last night, the fact that you have three children who didn't disclose for such a long period of time actually demonstrates the hold that these people have and the ways that they have of getting into people's minds. So that takes time, it takes, you know, knowledge, it takes looking for things which are there.
And that's going to be key. And it takes relationship building, which you will not have if you're swapping social workers around. And
yeah.
Michelle Mulhern, can I ask you, we know that the survivors from this abuse situation, they've written to the Taoiseach now, they want a full commission of an investigation. We're being told that we're waiting to see what this National Review Panel reports. Is that adequate now? Do we need to just move beyond that? Because as Catherine said there, the questions here are really, really serious.
Yeah. Firstly, I'd just like to say that, I mean, I think Catherine has set it out very plainly at the point at which we're at. And I think she's very accurate in her I suppose her assertion that it's hard to see any reason why, when a situation like this is reported to a social worker or the appropriate authorities, that there wasn't action taken. I would hope that I understand that they have written to the Taoiseach. And I suppose the hope here is out of this devastation, out of this terrible situation, not only is it a terrible situation and that has happened to them personally, but the fact that they were in the care of the state and that this should happen, I think that is the part, you know, these things are happening, but that it should be detectable, that we can learn from this. I would say that when people, victims, come forward, that in this situation, that the system can learn from this. In relation to a commission of investigation, I would imagine that the appropriate way to proceed would be that the National Review Panel would report back, and then that the authorities to whom it refers and to whom it speaks, HSE, TUSLA, government, the minister, that then they would decide what are the appropriate steps here, because it is inexplicable right now as to how this could have happened. It was reported, the woman who was a child at the time who reported it was deemed credible. Personally, I don't understand it, but I know it's all devastating for the lives of the women now who have to deal with the fallout of this situation, which would seem that it could have and should have been prevented at a certain point. A line should have been drawn, but it continued, and not only for the person who complained, but for others.
But Aon, if I can come to you, like, if this turns out to be one poor decision in one office by, you know, one team of social workers, you know, will we just kind of shrug our shoulders and move on then? Because it seems to me that we, you know, we hear about this, you know, hopefully this will be a seminal moment, it'll be a turning point. We've had so many of these cases. We had the Kilkenny case.
I'd like to think it would be, but I hate to be honest and think that I'm not, I'm not, I'm
not convinced. I mean, I was a principal and a teacher in an area of acute disadvantage. I dealt with these agencies all the time. I would say that, look, people who work in this area from TUSLA as it is now to foster care families, I mean, these people work very, very hard. They have the child's interests at the heart of what they're trying to do. This is an unmitigated disaster for these children. First of all, you know, their family situation had led them to be in foster care. Then this outrage happened to them. And then, despite having probably not been able to trust anything in their lives, they went to an agency they thought they could trust. They were believed and they were just put back into harm's way. Now, I didn't see the program. I have to admit that. I'm just going by what I've heard. But I have to say, from a societal point of view, because we can get political about resources, and that is true, because like, I have a piece of legislation in the Senate next week about attendance rate for infants in primary schools and how we track that and how we put them under the Education Welfare Board and all the rest of it. But I know when that's passed, or if it is passed, we won't have enough welfare officers to inspect the attendance and do something about it. But societal attitude to vulnerable children in Ireland isn't great, because I have to put hand on heart and say, I don't think generally we really care. We'll care tonight and we'll care tomorrow and we might care next week. We had a children's rights referendum. About, 28% of people bothered to vote? It passed by a small amount. We are big on legacy. We're big on what happened in the 40s and 50s. We feel strongly about that. But when it comes to children now and the power we have now, I think the system is punch drunk. I think Irish society doesn't really have enough of a care for very vulnerable children. And I don't know why that is, because it's not easy dealing with vulnerable children. I mean, you deal with them, I've dealt with them. You know, the circumstances can be exasperating and exhausting, and dealing with the families and all the rest of it. But if it is going to be a seminal moment, then great. But I have to say, I'm less than expectant that it is.
Eugene, is that the case? I mean, as a politician, There is no political pressure on you. These things come along, there's a big outcry, we're all horrified. But when you're knocking on doors at the next election, is anybody going to say to you, what are you doing for children in foster care?
Well, I'd say very few, Katie, if I'm to be honest with you. I mean, Dunmore is in my constituency, Roscommon Galway. I live in the Roscommon part of it, and I knew absolutely nothing about this case until I heard Aoife Hegarty's promo going out. And I watched it, and I got it very, very difficult to watch it last night. And, you know, you go back 10 years, somebody brought it to my attention that 10 years ago, as you spoke about there, you did a programme on the threat to many, many children. And going back and listening to parts of that, comments on that programme, listen to Catherine there now, this issue is, you know, just tagging on and on and on without the real will to deal with it. But I would say, I mean, Aon is here, Michelle, and myself, Paul. I think we have to get together on this, and we have to really take it, you know, very, very seriously. Now, there are serious questions here to be answered by TUSLA and the HSE. There really are, considering what happened in that case. It's unbelievable, and I think we all have a responsibility and a duty. I looked at that girl last night, and no matter how, and she was so, so brave. I mean, her life is destroyed. I hope she can rebuild, but it'd be very, very hard for her to do that. And that is absolutely tragic. So I think we all have a responsibility. But as you said, it won't be a big issue on the doorsteps, if you're to be honest.
Paul, there was an Oireachtas Committee report last year in relation to foster care and this whole service area. And there was recommendations. You know, I don't see any rush to anyone checking how many of these recommendations have been followed through on. It does seem to me that this is definitely the Cinderella of services, because it's hidden. It's, you know, it's only when at very rare occasions when it cuts through into the public domain that we have a sense of what can happen and what will happen if we don't resource this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the survivors in speaking out, you know, it's just an incredible bravery to be able to do that. And I think we can say it might be a seminal moment, it might not be a seminal moment, but the point is it has to become a seminal moment. Them speaking out can't just be allowed to be, oh, that was the horrific case that came out in 2018 and they spoke out about it and then we had 2019 and 2020. And that isn't a foregone conclusion either way. You know, that's an open question as to whether it becomes a seminal moment or it doesn't. And I think that, I mean, out there, society, like real society, ordinary people who were watching the TV last night, you know, they are appalled by it. Yes, they have busy lives, they have other things going on. This isn't the first thing in their mind most of the time. But there is a growing awareness and a consciousness, you know, about the issues of child abuse, and people want them. People are opposed to it, are horrified by it, would like proper resources to go in, etc. So I wouldn't blame society, as in people out there. I think responsibility more lies with official society. And I think the question there is that, for me, the starting point is, like, these women speaking out has the potential to transform the situation. So we have to listen to them and what they're requesting. And the first thing they're requesting is an independent commission of investigation. Mm. And I think the answer is to say yes to that immediately, whatever else is going on, because that will shine a light on things. I think that provides the possibility of this being a turning point. And that's many, many things. It's how it operates. It is resources. In saying resources, of course, that's not to say that, oh, resources are responsible for everything or bad mistakes can't be made. But the absence of sufficient resources creates a context whereby things are missed, things that shouldn't happen, happen, and so on. And I think that that is a broader part of the discussion, but that's not at all to take away from the horrors and the, clearly the mistake after mistake after mistake that was made in this case and many other cases.
Mary, should we have had to wait for the victims in this case to request that this be put to a commission investigation, given the seriousness of the issues involved and, as everyone seems to think, the inexplicable decisions that appear to have been made in relation to it? Should that not have been the starting point?
No, I don't think we should have had to wait for the victims to call for such a commission. I think, you know, there should have been sufficient concern in the first place, you know, from people watching this programme last night and at a political level, that they would automatically come out and say, we've got to the bottom of this. I think this might be symptomatic of what we've heard discussed here as a sort of social attitude to the issue of child protection, where maybe there isn't enough concern in this country when it comes to those issues. And as for whether it's a seminal moment, well, we've thought that we've had plenty of seminal moments in the past. And what does often happen is that various reviews or inquiries are set up and they make recommendations and then they just fall into the ether. You know, you spoke about the Oireachtas Committee not being in any rush to implement its recommendations. There was a story recently in regard to the number of centres in the country for which provide forensic examination and, you know, combine medical and therapeutic and policing services. This is for children who have just been, who have recently been abused. It's the, sort of the front line of examining these children. There's one such centre in the country and it's in Galway. There was a call in 2011 to set up, I think it was four centres around the country. A committee was set up at that point in 2011. Nothing was done. Another committee was set up again in 2015 and that has met just three times since it was set up. The last time it met was in May 2016. So that just gives a flavour of the sort of urgency with which these matters are treated.
It really is a disgrace that you know, so we have a situation where a child who presents having been abused sexually, the only place in the country at the moment for therapeutic and forensic is in Galway.
There was a Garda inspector report on this in 2012, which is highly critical of this. On that basis, another committee was set up to examine this, and that is the committee that's only met three times. So nothing has been done, despite this being identified as a problem back in 2011.
Catherine, if there was one thing, the first thing, what should be the priority to get some change into the system after this?
I think for us all to take collective responsibility. And I think that there are a number of ways in which that can be done. And Paul spoke about ordinary people. I mean, ordinary people can come forward as foster carers. Mm-hmm. And that's us taking ownership. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And we have to value it and we have to support people. That's one thing that people can do. We have to have a greater understanding of children and families in our community who probably need help. We need to have a greater understanding as to the pressures which professionals are operating under, because there's bad practice
practice as well. It's not just resources. There's bad practice. And it really concerns me because trying to differentiate what bad practice arises because there's nobody else in the office there and you have 30 cases and you can't figure out who's to go where and you've just missed something, as opposed to somebody who perhaps shouldn't actually be doing the job that they're doing. And they're really serious issues and they need to be differentiated. And that generates total fear in everybody. And the very conscientious people who are sitting in their offices at 11 o'clock at night, who are emailing the weekend because that's the only time that they get to do their paperwork, those people then are, in one sense, as likely to make mistakes as the others. And we have to have a system where if you are a really good and dedicated practitioner, you're supported and you have that. But also where there's bad practice, you know, it needs to be called out and needs to be eradicated. And I think that it is that general thing, the education, the judiciary, the courts, everybody involved in it. And as Aidan talked about, I mean, schools are absolutely key in this.
Yeah.
I think the Children First reporting legislation actually is starting to disseminate to, you know, doctors, schools, a whole range of professionals and, you know, volunteers working with children, that actually this is all of our responsibility. And hopefully that message is getting out there. But I really would like people to say to politicians on the door, you know, I felt really annoyed about this. Like, how many, if you actually took a straw poll, I felt really annoyed about this. And then ask yourself, how many times have I actually said to a politician or even my neighbour down the road, do you know, I'm really annoyed about this. Is there anything that we can do about it? And I think it goes back to, there's somebody else's children.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understand why you're done yesterday. And a lot of people are saying, God, I just find it too difficult to watch.
Mm.
I think there's a responsibility to watch it.
Well, isn't,
no matter how
isn't
hard
it is.
Isn't
very bad that, that we have a collective nervous breakdown in this country about every 10 years about the issue of the unborn? But when it comes to actually born children who are actually living, breathing in communities, in vulnerable situations, we just don't want to talk about it.
Okay. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Catherine is going to leave us, but do stay tuned because when we come back, we will be looking at what's happening in Leinster House and in the Independent Alliance. We'll talk to you after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, is Sean Canny going to pull out of the Independent Alliance? And what are the implications if he does? Mary Regan, what... is this what happens when you, you know, decide who is going to be Minister of State on a flip of a coin?
Well, you know, this is what isn't supposed to happen to a group of independents. The whole point of the Independent Alliance is that they were coming together and they insisted they weren't a political party. But it seems that they're able to take the parts of being in a party when it suits them, and they're able to take the parts of being an independent when it suits them as well. And this is exactly sort of the sort of problems that parties find themselves in. Often, you know, just fighting over jobs. I just think, you know, it just reflects badly on the group. This argument seems to be about entitlement, who deserves the job, whose turn it is on the flip of a coin. Rather than who's
better suited. Let's just remind people what it is. It's that they decided.
They decided when the Independent Alliance agreed to support Fine Gael minority government, there was a couple of ministerial jobs, a couple of super junior jobs and a couple of junior jobs. And Sean Canny and Kevin Boxer-Moran had decided by a flip of a coin who would take a junior ministerial position in the Department of the Office of Public Works, essentially the Minister for Floods, as it were. And then they didn't expect the government to last this long, I take it.
Basically, Sean Canny got the first shift the first year, and then the deal was that after year one, Kevin Boxer-Moran would step in. And then it seems that Sean Canny believed or understood that once his year was up, that he would step back in.
Exactly,
But that wasn't accepted by his colleagues.
Yeah, that wasn't the case. And so I think the disagreement is whether they would rotate on a yearly basis or whether the change of seat was, you know, for the long term or not.
So do you think, from the word around Leinster House, where it stands now, I know we were hearing on the news there at nine that he spoke with the Taoiseach today, Sean Canny. He will let us know his thoughts on his future over the coming days. What would
the
you put your money on?
You know, I think this is just typical sort of behaviour. He'll, you know, wrestle with his conscience, I'm sure, and consult his constituencies and keep us all talking about him for the next couple of days. My own view is that he'll probably stay in ultimately. But again, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, he could stay in. Michelle, you're looking at the runes. He could stay in government supporting. He could agree to stay in support of the government but leave the Independent Alliance.
He could, but I suppose in relation to internal agreements within the members of the Independent Alliance, the TDs that form the Independent Alliance, it's really a matter for them. In relation to, I suppose, the fact that this is arising is probably points to the fact that when the agreement was designed originally, people mightn't have thought that the government would last this long, and it actually has.
But didn't Micheál Martin put on the record that Kevin Boxer-Moran said to him in the corridors of Leinster House when he asked him, how is this going to work out? And Kevin Boxer-Moran apparently said, sure, are you joking? This isn't going to last.
Well, I think he mightn't have been the only person who might have responded in that way. But what I would say is I really don't mind which of them would be junior minister for the OPW, because I've dealt with both and I found them very satisfactory. We have major issues in relation to flooding in Ballina and Cross Malina in the area that I'm from, devastating problems, and they've been very responsive. And also, you know, we've had investment in infrastructure like Cage of Fields, and so they're very hands-on, and whichever of them it is, obviously it's going to be, it seems it would be Kevin Boxer-Moran now. I mean, I wouldn't have any objection.
Doesn't the whole thing just expose the Independent Alliance for what it was, though? Which was an attempt to exploit the need of people and the wish of people to break with establishment party politics, to go for something different, which was encapsulated by the notion of an Independent Alliance. And it was dressed up as that, but in reality it was a vehicle for people to get ministerial positions, to get assistant government whip positions, to get resources, to get all of those things. That's all the whole project was ever about. And it's quite badly exposed, I'd say, by this kind of unseemly row that nobody has any interest in. Do ordinary people care whether Boxer-Moran has it or Sean Canning? Of course they don't. But it's pretty badly exposed. Mm. It's like, that's all this is ever about.
Sorry. Just to say, I think that's, you know, at the end of the day, anybody putting themselves forward to get elected, they're looking to get in a position of authority, wherever that will be, whether it's a TD, backbencher, part of a loose alliance, part of a party. And the more you can progress within that, the more authority you have to implement some sort of change. And politicians are very artful and resourceful in relation to doing that. So as though this is a big expose in relation to the internal machinations of how politicians and independents work, I don't think it's true. I think it's
any politics. If there was any politics here, well, then he would decide, I agree with what the government is doing, I'm going to vote with the government, or I disagree
Give him a chance.
Kenny believes he would do it better. Question.
There's a programme for government. There's a programme for government, and there's issues like Brexit, housing, health. All these, and I'm sure these are the things that Sean Canning is thinking about and that we want to drive on towards addressing them. I am. As I say, I've had a lot of dealings with the man. I found him to be quite honourable and conscientious.
Eugene, you're trying to get in there.
Well, to use Mary's term again, I'm the Fianna Fáil spokesperson for floods, so I've had the opportunity to work closely with both men and I suppose mark them in it all. Neither of them live too far from me, and I have to say both of them are quite, you know, dedicated to what is a big, big issue now, the damage that has been done to many communities throughout the country. I suppose Sean Canning probably thinks he did a lot of the groundwork and laid the groundwork, and there's no doubt about it, Boxer-Moran has also committed himself quite well. But the whole thing is a bit farcical, to be honest, and it will destabilise the government to some effect. Well, my guess is that Sean Canning will pull away, but I think he will take every vote on an issue. I think he will use it as a bargaining tool on certain issues.
Absolutely.
And he will go to Leo and say, right, you have my vote if you deliver.
Yeah,
there's a lot of talk in the media about the 15,000. I think knowing Sean Canning,
his 15,000 stipend for being assistant government.
And I don't think that's going to come into it at all. And I think by the weekend he will have decided, I'm going to fire a shot here over the bows, and I'm going to vote on every issue, depending on what the government give me. And that's the way politics works sometimes.
Well, isn't that just, he's going to become a Jackie Healy Ray? Yeah.
Well, I mean.
the Father Ted Alliance is what I've called them. I mean, I think they think the whole thing's a bit of a laugh. I mean, I observed them, all the lads in the, and they are all lads in the Independent Alliance, and you just get the sense from them that this is all a bit of a joke.
Hold on, I didn't, I'm very disrespectful.
I mean, well, look, you just look at what some of the stuff they come out with, you know what I mean? The HPV, HPV vaccine. Oh, sorry, Michelle, am I able to finish
well,
the sentence?
You don't Thanks. Let everyone in the Shannon finish, so.
Okay, but we're not in the Shannon now, and yes, I might just finish my sentence. So we have the whole, you know, the HPV vaccine debacle, the questioning stance on smoking bans, the North Korea nonsense. I mean, we were in government for a period of time, 5 years, as people remember. We did some good things, did some bad things, but we would never have gotten away with some of the stuff that's going on. The step aside Garda station, for example, the stuff in Wessex, we would have been hounded by every media journalist or organisation. Can you send over this?
Well, well I think a lot of the issues you've just mentioned there were well thrashed out in the media.
Well, right, but you know, politics is a serious business, and you're trying to actually deliver things for people. And the fact that the thing that the Independent Alliance are now in the media for now, wouldn't it be wonderful if you got a sense that they were driving a political agenda and an ideological agenda about something that genuinely we're trying to achieve for the country, they're having a coin toss over who gets the job. And I agree with what has been said. I am quite sure that Sean Kenny will go home and he'll wrestle with his conscience and he'll pick up a piece of paper and a pen and he'll write down the list of pet projects for himself and it'll be delivered for him on Tuesday.
I think just independents were the big success story of the last election campaign, and they really did capitalise on the breakdown of trust in the mainstream political parties. And they had a promise really to change the way politics was done in this country. They gave us this great hope. The Independent Alliance's logo was radical but responsible. And I don't think they've been radical apart from their proposal to send a Peace Corps to, you know, North Korea. I haven't seen any policies coming from them that are in any ways unorthodox or look like, you know, that they're shaping politics really for the better. In terms of being responsible, Aon mentioned his constituency rival Finian McGrath. He, in some ways, might be considered one of the best of them in terms of how he's performed in his department. But he did make comments about the HPV vaccine at the same time that his Department of Health was trying to run a campaign to promote the vaccine. You know, Shane Ross, we've seen the Sunday Business Post has reported in recent weeks the awarding of a €150,000 grant to a private school
which he says he had nothing to do with.
Well, he said he had nothing to do with it, but at the same time, he tweeted how delighted he was to announce the news.
Again, to be fair, is there a politician around this table who would not take credit for
this? Is everything that the Independent Alliance
their constituency
said
like
they
that.
Wouldn't be.
They're supposed to be against.
I think they've come to represent the worst, you know, traits of party politics that they purported to.
Eugene,
I would hope in all of this that we're not losing sight of what needs to be done for communities up and down the country. There's a big budget there, I have to say.
For flood, is the whole area, flood relief.
And I mean, still, down in my constituency and through the Midlands and right down on the Shannon, people are still suffering from the last few storms and floods.
I would say that Ken Boxamoran has got a lot of praise, particularly for a colleague of mine in Galway, Councillor Neil McNeillis, is very complimentary of his work, in fairness to him.
We do need to keep focused on that in this situation. And I would hate to see anything happening that, you know, would lead to a situation where that work would be interrupted by this farcical row that's going on. It is really so important to communities up and down the country, but that's why I'd say that the whole thing is very farcical and it's unfortunate.
Okay, we'll move on, we'll wait and see what Sean Kenny decides, but now let's move on to the Irish Rugby Football Union withdrawing a job advert for an unpaid internship that would have required the successful candidate to have a master's or a PhD. It later said that it was published in error. And of course, the Workplace Relations Commission says that any employees, even interns, are entitled to the minimum wage. But is this what's happening out there in practice? And of course, we must also look at this in the context of the whole issue and growing issue of precarious contracts. Paul Murphy, your party isn't happy with the explanation from the IRFU on this.
Well, I think the idea that this was some innocent mistake that was swiftly changed when someone pointed out to them, obviously, isn't very credible. I think they have questions to answer about whether there are any unpaid interns currently working for them. I think it raises question marks over other sporting organisations. Are there interns working for free there? And it raises a much broader question about in the economy as a whole, how many people are working for free as interns? And I mean, this is a huge problem. It's obviously, it is linked to the growing precarity of work, the massive increase in the number of people who are part-time employed, the massive increase in the number of people who are on temporary contracts, the massive increase of the number of people who are so-called bogus self-employed. And we have to remember, this isn't something where the government or the state is kind of a neutral bystander. The last government drove unpaid work with the Job Bridge scheme, and that was working for free for 9 months. They were eventually forced to close it under public pressure. I think this government ended up doing it maybe a year into this government. But you have the Job Path scheme existing at the moment. You have just precarious existence of people, and it's a huge problem that, you know, if you look at wage rates, I mean, wage rates haven't gone up since the point of the bottom point of the crisis, if they've gone up, they've gone barely up. Cost of housing, cost of childcare, all those things are going up, and working conditions are very, very hard for people. And the idea of working for free, it's an extreme example of what's happening in the labour market.
Eoin, Jobbridge, your party defended it to the hilt.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and it's
a
nice.
A lot of people felt used and abused.
Yeah,
under that scheme.
Yeah, well, you know, two thirds of people who went through it got permanent employment. One third didn't. It was an emergency. Hold on, just let me finish.
Yeah, well, this is not true.
It actually is true. But it was an emergency measure in a period of economic crisis and massive.
Were you uncomfortable about it though?
I was uncomfortable with a heap of stuff. I can give you a list of a heap of stuff I was uncomfortable with during those.
Well, if you'll just write that down later,
you know, I mean, you know, you walk into government and look, we rehearsed these arguments last general election. We had a heavy defeat and people didn't take what we said as being a reasonable argument, and we lost a huge amount of support for it. But I mean, you walk into a situation where there's a massive unemployment and economic collapse, and you do things you never thought you would do. But anyway, the economy right now is doing better, and that's, I take Paul's point, in terms of it's not just about this one ad from the IRFU, it's about the future of work. And we have been, as a party, laying out our belief system in terms of the future of work and what work will look like, you know, not buying into this nonsense of the gig economy, talking about bogus self-employment, talking about zero-hour contracts, talking about basic standards of living wages and all the rest of it. And Jack O'Connor has been very strong at this. And Jed Nash, in the Senate, has been driving through legislation, and he was obviously the one who pushed forward the low wage commission. So we have a conversation to have as a society as we come out of this period of economic collapse, as what work is, what work workers should, what rights they should expect, and what terms of and conditions they should be the basic minimum standard for any worker. And we shouldn't go back and forget everything of the hurt of the last number of years as if it never happened, because a lot of hurt happened and we have to learn from it.
Michelle Mulhern, when your Taoiseach and your enterprise minister stands up and makes those job announcements, before they do that, do they ask questions about the quality of the jobs they're announcing, or is it, you know, never mind the quality, feel the width?
Yeah, well, a lot of the job announcements would be like clusters of jobs, maybe FDI or Indigenous industry, where they're substantial numbers. Generally, other than in local media, they don't get national attention unless that's the case. So generally, those jobs would tend to be of, I suppose, a more full-time permanent type of nature. And if you drill down on the figures, which I don't have here to hand, but I have had cause to question it because of commentary about, oh, you know, there's part-time and it's all precarious. It's not. The majority of jobs created are full-time positions. We have a minimum wage, which has been increased. Can I make a point in relation to the internships and that, if I might? I think perhaps people might accept that there is a place for internships and apprenticeships where it's an advancement in your career for a short period of time and where we know it's not been abused. And I think, so to say, I'm not justifying the IRFU situation or anything like that. What I'm saying is that's part of a system, and we're proposing to introduce more apprenticeships. So to say that...
Well, there's a big difference now, Michelle, between an apprenticeship and an unpaid internship. surely that we are not putting those into the
Well, what I'm saying is that getting work experience towards ultimately, which is practical experience, which will count towards advancing your career, your professional career, I don't know that that should necessarily be ruled out. But if you're talking about basically taking in somebody to do a job where it's being abused, where basically this is somebody that's going to be doing tasks and work which they're getting that person to do for free, that really somebody else should be paid, and it's not really in keeping with their career. So I suppose there is a fine line, but I don't think you can rule it out, because a lot of people have had valuable experience, connections, networking, etc., and then they proceed on. So I don't know that it's as black and white as you're saying.
Mary, like, media is one of those industries mm-hmm. where a lot of people are expected to do a lot of things for either very little money on precarious contracts. I have colleagues in this mm-hmm. organisation who are working on those kind of contracts mm-hmm. or do it for free. And that's just one example of one industry. I'm sure you've come across.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, journalism, it's the kind of business where you need to get, you know, sort of a bit of experience behind you in order to open doors. I mean, most people start off their careers in journalism doing placements. I did a placement here in RT myself, and it was a great learning experience for me and opened a lot of doors for me. The problem now is, I mean, that was a more structured thing organised by the university. The problem now is that people are going into all areas of journalism working for free as internships. And the issue with that is that only people whose maybe parents can afford to keep them and who come from a certain background, therefore, can afford to do this, because you're not going to be working for free and trying to pay rent at the same time. It also means that a lot of people who are only from Dublin can afford to work in the media. And I think that, unfortunately, might narrow the sort of people who will ultimately become journalists, because it's the sort of profession that does need to have people from all backgrounds involved in it.
I mean, that's exactly the way that interns have traditionally been used. It's been a way of maintaining a certain class character of certain professions. Like, to be a barrister, you have to devil. You have to work for free for, I think it's 2 years. And only very few number of people can do that. Mm. But what's happened is that that's now been expanded into, like, a large part of the economy. There was a really good headline, an article I read earlier, that said, "Let them eat experience." You know, because that sums it up. It's like, oh, well, you're getting experience. You can put it on your CV, but there's a world of difference between putting a qualification on your CV that you get from an apprenticeship or you get from a college course that includes a placement, and just, oh, you put in your CV, you work for free. And it has a downward drive on
the economy. I'm going to ask you very quickly, because I am going to have to go to a break. Yeah, Eugene, well, very, very quickly.
Very quickly. I mean, if you look at the University of Limerick study, in excess of 50,000 people are on zero contracts. And that's a shocking indictment of our system. Now, under the confidence supply, we did get a commitment from Fine Gael that this casualisation of work would be dealt with, and we will support the bill. But the reality is, you know, and this comes so much to my constituency office, people on zero hour contracts are a lot of contract work, they can't get a mortgage. Mm. They have That's to true. Rent accommodation. Yeah. Yep. You know, it's totally unfair, and we have to tackle this issue mm. with so many people out there, you know, on zero hour contracts.
Okay, we'll have to take a break here, but don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we'll be talking about trouble in the paradise that is the confidence and supply deal.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, Finance Minister Pascal Dunne was keeping his cards close to his chest today ahead of the latest public sector pay negotiations. While in the Dáil, the Taoiseach accused Fianna Fáil of wholly dishonest politics for going around the country promising every interest group what they want. Imagine politicians going around the country promising interest groups everything they want. Eugene, he says he's keeping a record. And by his reckoning, Fianna Fáil's promises amount to hundreds of millions of euro each week.
Well, I think this is outrageous. And I have attended a number of Fianna Fáil conventions and a number of Fianna Fáil meetings over the weekend. And to be quite honest, there aren't promises like that being made. And I think this is a case of a Taoiseach panicking, running for cover. He's in trouble with the referendum at the moment, I've no doubt about that. He hasn't his own party fully behind him on it. And there are other issues as well. So the Taoiseach, you know, would want to realise that Fianna Fáil are keeping him there in power, and it's up to him whether he's going to do.
Michelle, it's Taoiseach panicking.
He doesn't look too panicky to me, so I think perhaps it's the other way around.
Very touchy today.
You know, very touchy.
Very touchy.
What it puts me in mind of is...
Totes touchy.
In advance of the 2006 election, multiples of letters went out to
all these schools that were looking for new school premises from Mary Hanafin.
How many have you announced? How many have you announced in recent weeks?
And if
very
I
much
can,
like an election promise.
Let me continue.
Richard Bruton has announced.
What I found when I got elected to Dáil Éireann in 2011, I regularly had school principals coming to me with letters they got from Mary Hanafin. Yeah. So I proceeded to go to Rory Quinn, who was the Minister for Education. Here's a commitment that was given.
Never made a commitment on anything.
How many schools has Richard Bruton announced? New schools.
You don't like the point I'm making. The point I'm making is this.
Okay, Michelle,
Rory Quinn clarified to me that there wasn't funding for 60% of what was promised at the time. The best promisers are Fianna Fáil. And they're true. They're true to form. And if we let them get the reins of power again, we'll have the country destroyed again. And it'll be more tears on the dance floor again.
This is the new ploy. This is the new ploy. It's definitely.
All right, Eugene. Listen to what we're saying here.
How many schools did your Minister for Education announce in recent weeks, bypassing the schools that are waiting for extensions, trying to get rid of prefabs? This is outrageous.
Well,
it's announcement after announcement from you.
And a lot of them are not going to come to fruition.
That's the reality.
Do you want me to start listing off all the schools in my area that had their prefabs?
How many new
prefabs
schools?
Prefabs for years and years.
But you're bypassing them.
No,
we're not.
We have new schools on the list and they're progressing also. So I have no complaints and I don't have complaints in my area.
You'd want to talk nicer to the minister.
He'd want to talk more nicer to the Minister for Education.
We're running out of time here. Does the Taoiseach have a point?
He always has a point when he criticises Fianna Fáil. just like Fianna Fáil have a point when they criticise the government. They're both capable of criticising each other, even though they're a mirror image of each other. It's like Aon and the Labour Party are now able to, you know, attack the government from the left, give out about them doing X, Y, and Z. And on Tuesday, Radcliffe was well able to turn around and say, Brendan Howland, well, there was a difference between your promised budgets and the budgets you actually implemented when you were in power.
And we know money.
But this is, we're obviously, it shows we're heading towards an election. They're finding a way to get themselves out. The temperature is getting a lot hotter around Leinster.
It doesn't mean it'll be
in the short term either, because they have to find a way to extricate themselves in a way that looks good.
Maybe we finally have the difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. If Fianna Fáil are going around the country making these promises and Fine Gael get them all out of the way in one clean sweep with Project 2014.
Exactly. All our new schools.
Aon.
I just want Eugene and Michelle to go at it again. I was enjoying that for, you know, the period of time that I got to, you know, observe it.
We're only getting warmed up.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything serious?
If you wouldn't mind.
I agree with Paul. I think they have to have some mechanism to have an election. I don't think anybody necessarily wants one, but, you know,
if you were going to call it, what's your sense of it now? You've been around.
Everybody thought it was going to be definitely this time, but the way that it all pans out, you have it's going to come the referendum, then the summer, then the pre-budget stuff, then you have a budget, and then nothing's going to happen after Christmas, and nobody wants a winter election. So I'd imagine it could actually be this time next year.
And we have Brexit too. Very serious.
Indeed, we do. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I just have the Irish Examiner front page and the headline there. Mary O'Rourke paid for women to travel for abortions. The subhead there is, I didn't look at the legalities. They came to me for practical help. There's also a headline there about the Sean Canny story. Canny working out solo deal as alliance rift widens. That's it for us. That's all from Late Debate tonight. Thanks to our panel. Research was by Fiona Donlan and the programme was produced by Brian Lally. Fiona Sweeney will be with you tomorrow night and I'll be back with you again next Wednesday. Now it's time for Late Date with Cathal Murray.